Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So how was that? For me, it was wonderful. In the third announcement, this incredible joy came up. Well, it was a lot of joy anyway, but just right, kind of at the third announcement, hey, he's a bhikkhu. So where the joy is both having a good friend, because Bhikkhu Kema is a very, very good friend and very helpful, and he's got a good mind. It's nice to talk Dhamma with him. But also this life for me has been just fantastic. I'm just so surprised at this life. You'd think everyone's got the same outfit. It must be boring, right? But I've just met the most wonderful people, and I've lived in the most marvelous places. I have fantastic peers who are really wise and dedicated people, and I have like families all over the place. I have a Perth family, a Toronto family, an Ottawa family, a New Zealand family, an England family. So all over the world. So it's a very, very rich life, surprisingly. Very rich life. And it comes from an aspiration and maybe desperation. It comes from a kind of dual sensibility, I think, that we all have. On one hand, it's somehow not a rejection of contemporary society, but just the contemporary ways of finding fulfillment through family or vocation, service, expressive arts, different ways that we find fulfillment in life. Those particular ways somehow, I think, for a samana, for a one who has gone forth, somehow don't fit. So there's a sense of disinterest or that's just not my way. And that's a very, very difficult mind state to dwell with when there is, I think, any young person who hasn't found their niche, hasn't found their vocation, hasn't found their partner, hasn't found their family, whatever way you want to talk about, that sort of, there's a kind of despair there. But that despair can be very, very good, because it keeps one looking. Certainly that was my case, and I think with Bhikkhu Kema's case, there's this sense of looking for, but not quite sure looking for what. And then one comes across a spiritual teaching which talks about a transcendent realization. And in Buddhism, we don't have a theistic model. We have a different kind of model, so we use a kind of abstract language to talk about transcendent realization or spiritual realization. So the common word you hear is Nibbana. But Nibbana has become a bit corrupted, because it sounds like a spa in Arizona or something. It doesn't really sound transcendent anymore. But there is that, I think, in the human heart, which aspires to some kind of spiritual realization, deep peace, deep compassion. So this combination of both disenchantment, but also, oh, there is this other possibility, direction. And getting direction is a big thing in any person's life, finding a direction, be it being the vocation of a nurse or whatever it might be. And the particular direction that we take, it comes a lot from very much how we think the Buddha experienced his renunciation, because the Buddha's own questioning, Siddhartha's own questioning, was one of meaning. And that question of meaning came forth from his contemplation of the limitations of all the things around him, because he's a very successful being, very powerful being, very accomplished being. You know, he wasn't like in therapy for being really messed up. He wasn't. He was really, really a clear being, very clear being. And yet, there was that despair in him. And I can really relate to that. I know for myself, I had a good family, and Toronto's a great city, and it was U of T and so on, but there's this constant sense of this isn't it. And it's quite a difficult thing to carry, and it took me about 7 years before I found, now this is it. And we have two words in the Pali, Sangvega and Pasada. Sangvega is the sense of kind of like futility. Where is this going to? What's the point of doing this? Sometimes that comes up when someone's in the family dies. You know, someone dies, and you think, well, what am I doing with my life? Where is it going? What's important? What is meaningful? Sometimes it comes when there's a great loss or whatever. Sometimes it's just a sort of innate characteristic in some people's minds. So I know for me that was very, very true. And then finding a teaching or a way where there is meaning. There is meaning, and there is meaning in all the things of life, all the sufferings and turmoils we have of life, and that meaning is one of inner realization. And that's what we call pasada, or this kind of clear clarity and confidence. This is the path. This is what I'd like to do. And I think Bhikkhu came ahead, has both those. He sees the Sangvega, he sees the futility of some things for himself, and then he sees, this is a way. And that's what we are kind of celebrating, but also encouraging, because the work of a monastic is work. It's to get your head sorted out and get the mind concentrated and not be just the victim of old emotional habits. To live in community with we're a powerful bunch of guys, aren't we? You get kind of hear that in the chanting, and we get along. You know, it's not easy. You know, a group of men who have strong aspiration, have strong minds, have strong opinions, have strong ideas of what truth is, and so on. And how do we do that? How do we do that? Well, the ordination is a way of reminding Bhikkhu Kema that now he is coming into an order that has a certain rule. It has a certain structure. It has a certain etiquette. It has a certain way of behavior. It has hierarchy. It has a sense of respect for elders. It has in it respect for resources. It has in it respect for lay people and so many other things. And that's the common rule that we all abide by. And it's very, very beautifully designed, actually. And this is the one thing that the Buddha couldn't offer to the laity, because lay people had different lives, you know, different vocations and different structures in society and so on. And so he couldn't offer a sort of detailed guideline of living for the lay people. It was more kind of general suggestions around precepts and living a responsible life. But for the monastic community, he offered a way of training which grew over the period of his teaching. So the Buddha, we think, taught for about 45 years. So it's quite a long, long time he was there. And in the first, we reckon, and we're not sure, maybe the first 20 years, there was really no need for any kind of rules. The order was small. The spiritual practitioners who came to him were quite pure in their conduct and in their wisdom, so there was no need for any rules. And then slowly, as the order grew in size, then different kinds of people came. There were misunderstandings. There were monks who misused the opportunity to be a mendicant, and rules were laid down. And these rules then evolved over the next 25 years. And those rules come to us, and then we try to interpret them in this Western culture. And we try to interpret them where we're honoring the core ideas of the rules, but we're not just blindly holding to them in some kind of fearful, legalistic way. We're trying to find how can we do monk in this society. And when I went to England in 1977, we didn't really know if this would work. And I remember reading an article by a monk who was a kind of trying to adapt Buddhism to the West, as it were. And he said, well, monks shouldn't wear robes. They should wear a brown jacket and brown corduroys or whatever you wear in England. and they should drive a car, have a salary, and cook their own food. And then when they went into their temple, they could put their robes on. So we read that. I read that. I said, I'm going back to Thailand if I have to do that. I didn't sign up for that. But fortunately, we said, well, we'll just try this. We'll just try this particular way of life and see if it has relevance. And we tried it, and it worked. There was a way that Western culture could say, yeah, this has relevance. And it takes some adjusting. But little by little, people began to see that our way of life has relevance to them. And this kind of symbiotic relationship has grown over the years in many different kind of monasteries. The work of a monk, the method, say, let us say the method of enlightenment is goodness. That's the method, not the goal. And that's compassion is the method. You do compassion. And why do you do compassion? Or you do generosity, or you do nonviolence, or you do meditation, or you do being dutiful. It's a doing. And that doing is always moving towards that which is wholesome, that which is skillful, and that which is non-egotistic. And the other of not doing the unwholesome, not doing the unskillful, not doing the cruel, not doing the petty, not doing etc., 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 that is the letting go or the abandonment of the unwholesome. And this is the way we sometimes talk about the effort that we put forth in our lives, the cultivation of the wholesome and the abandonment of the unwholesome. So it's doing good. Good on many levels. Good on, obviously, at a moral level and at a communal level. We have a lot of rules about speech, because you know speech. You know, one email can destroy. One tweet, I suppose, can really be hurtful in the world. It's crazy now. But just like our rules around admonishment, just like that. Say, if I want to admonish Bhikkhu Kema for some reason, I have to, even though I'm senior and I'm Zupachaya, I still have to think, am I pure in this? Is my heart free from anger? Do I understand the rules? Is this the time and place? Is it appropriate? Will it be helpful to him? Etc., etc., etc. I can't just blurt out, you're late. Can't do that. I could, but then that's not what my training is about. So my training is about, to some extent, waiting on speech. What is right? What is appropriate? And what does that do for the mind when I have a kind of discipline around that? And that first impulse to hurt or to be critical or whatever, right? That first impulse, I pause on an impulse. That's a movement towards goodness. Because that pause helps me to see the impulse, and then I have a choice whether I want to follow the impulse or not. And if you have a set of rules and principles that help you to pause 24/7, it's really, really helpful, very, very helpful. We have a kind of communal agreements on the way we use resources. So our resources are held by the community in trust from the laity, and they're distributed equally. We distribute the alms food equally, the robes equally. I must admit, I get some goodies sometimes but they indulge me. So sometimes there is that where one, you know, there's an old guy that's been around, you give him an extra jar of honey, but I don't have a Rolls, or so it's quite innocent and quite beautiful. But this sense of sharing resources is rather than hoarding resources or getting a bigger alms bowl than the other monk or whatever, it seems ridiculous, doesn't it? Seems ridiculous. And so that sense of egalitarian, communal, harmonious goodness is fostered all the time, is cultivated all the time. And that doesn't mean that we're goody goods. We've got our stuff. You know, we can feel all the emotions of any human being. But the whole ethos and the whole structure of our lives is to remind us that's not the way to go. Don't go the ego path. Don't follow that one. If a monk has, if he feels he has some kind of attainment, And he starts to brag about it. Can't do it. Right? Can't do that. If he lies, he's not a monk anymore. One of the four rules that I recited at the end there, that it's a rather strange rule. If a monk lies about some kind of supernormal attainment, then he is no longer a monk in that lying. But even if it's truthful, he shouldn't be doing it. Now, why is that? Why is that? Well, because the monastic order gets a lot of praise, gets a lot of resources, and the danger of a monk who has a lot of power or a lot of charisma is that they become corrupted and they lead lay people in the wrong way. So at the time of the Buddha, there was there were monks who were misleading lay people by lying about their own attainments. And we've seen that in modern culture. A guru who says, I've got the goods, if you stick with me, I'll take care of you. And so we have kind of interesting rules about protecting the laity, protecting the monastic community. Obviously, the sort of central theme of our lives is meditation. There's the social structures that we live by. But meditation is very much the core of developing the path to enlightenment. And we're given a lot of time to do that, and we're required to do that. So our routine here is one where we have work in the morning and then meditation. We try to do our own meditation in the afternoon, evening, morning. We do long retreats. That's a particular hobby that not many people pick up. It's a particular kind of interest and craft and skill that is a necessary part of being a monk. People like, if someone in our tradition is not really interested in meditation, they wouldn't be here. They'd go to another tradition that is maybe scholastic. And in meditation, we're faced with the reality of our own inner world. And whatever conditioning our inner world has is where it's at now. When we stop, when we sit on the cushion, when there's no distraction, when there's nothing to do, we are faced with what our minds have developed. And quite often, in the beginning, that's restlessness, boredom comes up, or anger, or whatever. And our task is to begin to awaken to all of that, our inner world. And the root of the word Buddha is awakened. So to awaken, like let's say, I've never wanted to disrobe. I've been one of the lucky. I'm a lifer, by the way. I've never wanted to disrobe. But if a monk wants to disrobe, there's nothing wrong with that, is there? There's nothing wrong. A monk can disrobe. But to actually notice something like disenchantment with the monastic life as an object, as a type of mind, to be awake to that. What that does, it begins to point to something which is beyond enchantment and disenchantment, something beyond inspiration and disappointment, and that's Nibbana. The ideas of Nibbana is that they're beyond duality. So in monastic life, what happens is like a monk will feel maybe very inspired, everything's going well, he's healthy, da-da-da-da-da, and then one day something happens, he gets sick, his meditation's not working, he gets bored. So the initial inspiration arises, and that's birth. You're born, this inspiration is great, this is great, this is great, this is great. But that's not going to last. As much as I would like Bhikkhu Kama to always be inspired, life isn't that way, is it? Life is not a constant up, up, up high. Life has troughs in it, up and down, up and down. But the ideas around Nibbana, about transcendence, are that there is that in the mind which knows the movement. There is that in the mind which can see the highs, can know the lows, can see the change, and that does not change. And that's the secret of this transcendent path. The secret is not the experience of high or low, but that which is behind it, which is a silent knowing, which is a peaceful knowing. Now, we don't usually notice that because we are so enthralled by the peaks and troughs of life. So the troughs of life bring us into depression or disappointment or whatever, and then we seek a distraction to get away from those, and we might find a peak of inspiration, but then the trough comes again. Now, monastic life has very little peaks and troughs that are come from the outside. One meal a day, blueberry pie, You know, it's really hard to get too excited. We try, but it's... So the monastic life is a very, very kind of even life. Like, I don't have much memory of monastic life. What do you remember? Morning chanting? You know, it's just the same, the same, the same. And that might seem terribly, terribly boring. And if you're looking for excitement, yeah. But our life is not the seeking of excitement. It's the curiosity about transcendence. Right? So the life is designed to non-distraction, non-excitement. So hence we have rules around entertainment. We have rules around music and things like that. These are not moral rules. We're not saying that music is bad or that YouTube presentations are bad or that all that. It's not so much a moral statement. More, it's just a statement. If your mind is always out into objects, fascinated by objects, disgusted by objects, depressed by objects, inspired by objects, you're looking in the wrong place. And that's that great story of Nasruddin. Nasruddin was the crazy Sufi. And he was sitting outside a spice shop. And there's this huge basket of chilies, these dynamite chilies they use in Thailand. And Nasruddin is chewing on this chili, and he's crying his eyes out. His mouth is just burning up. His eyes are burning. And he takes another one, and another one, another one. And his mate comes by and says, Nasruddin, what are you doing? And Nasruddin says, I'm looking for a sweet one. And so the Buddha's teaching is saying the really sweet one is not outside of you. Or that which is beyond sweetness and hotness is not outside of you. It's something in your heart, something inwards. And so our life is one where it's a kind of designed life where those external pulls are taken away, but in a voluntary way, and not as a moral thing. And we're not moralizing about music or the arts or whatever. It's just an ultra-simplified life. And then within that, what we're seeing is if we can sustain awareness of change, if I can see the ups and downs of my life and see they change, but what is unchanging? Peaks come and go, the troughs come and go. What's unchanging? That's the question we begin to ask ourselves in meditation. And you begin to see there's the movement of thought, the movement of bodily feeling, the movement of memory, the movement of sound and sight, sense experience. That's moving, but what's unmoving? And the meditator begins to intuit that, begins to taste that, begins to abide as that, and realizes Nibbana. That's the progression, and it's a kind of inward progression. Whereas a life of distraction is always trying to, as they say, trying to arrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, kind of get it right before the ship sinks. And that is, we do that. I mean, here, I mean, I have tea with honey. It's not like I don't enjoy the senses at all, but I know that tea with honey is not Nibbana. It's just tea with honey. So it's limited. It's limited. So the sense experiences we have, realize they're limited. And they can be useful. Beauty can be useful. Arts can be useful. I certainly like a warm sweater on a cold day. It's all useful. But its utility is like the basis for enlightenment. It's not an end in itself. Fashion isn't an end in itself. Music isn't an end in itself. Because it's just changing. It's not really stable. It's not really reliable. So what is reliable? We would say what's reliable is, first of all, you can be aware of the way things are. That doesn't seem like much. It's not like a pension plan. And I'm not advocating you give up your pension plan, because we only do this every 5 years. So I'm not advocating that. But but there is like this spiritual stability in the mind, what we call refuge, which is always available to us. Always available. And we don't notice it because our lives are very distracted. So meditation then is a way of quite consciously, quite deliberately, systematically, persistently coming to that state of non-grasping, of peacefulness. And the more we abide as that, that knowing, Buddha knowing Dharma, as we say, the more we abide as that, we realize that is the goal. That is the goal. I'm here already. And so goodness is a foundation for that. If I speak to Bhikkhu Kema in a kind way, I'm going to go back to my hut and feel quite good. If I speak to him in an unkind way, I'm going to go back to my hut and I'm going to feel remorse or some kind of negative memory. So the more I can be with him in a good way, the more that goodness is a foundation for my own peace. And then that foundation for peace I can take inwards to the understanding of the transcendent. So our social life is based on goodness, and that's the method. That's the method. If I was just a goody-good monk, always doing good works, always externalizing serving and giving Dharma talks and writing books and going to conferences, I'd just be exhausted. But also I wouldn't be doing my inner work, because I would think that the outside is the most important. If I did no outside work, if I was just selfishly sitting on my meditation cushion and said, shut up, leave me alone, I'm getting enlightened, that wouldn't work either, because it would just be a selfish self-indulgence. Wouldn't work either. So our way as Buddhist monastics is a kind of middle way, where we learn to serve, we learn to help, we try to express ourselves in ways of compassion and communal sharing and generosity to the lay people and so on. But also, we're always attentive to the inner world and trying to find that place of deep peace, which is available to all of us. So all of you who have come here today to witness this ceremony, remember that all of us have a responsibility to Bhikkhu Kema. We've been here, we've seen him ordained, so all of us want to encourage him in his path. And he has a responsibility to us to live by the monastic rule and to take this commitment deeply. Because the chanting that he did, among other things, it said that the purpose of this ordination is the realization of Nibbana. This is not a selfish thing. My first teacher said it's the selfishness that puts an end to selfishness. We look at our teachers, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Liam, the Buddha himself. The heart has tremendous possibility of serving when it's freed from ego, free from selfishness. But one has to do the inner work first. One has to do the inner work. So we're giving Bhikkhu Kema a chance to do that inner work first, not getting caught up in teaching a retreat next year or writing his first memoir the year after that, and then a book, and then a book tour. And so we'll save him that for a few years and just let him meditate quietly and fix engines. So with that, I'd like to wish you well and thank you for coming today, and wish you realization of Nibbana.